Hello, Josh Gilliland here, one of the co-founders of Legal Geeks. With me is a special guest, Melinda Snodgrass, famed author who has to her credit 5 Star Trek The Next Generation episodes to her credit, and also as a personal favorite, SeaQuest, which was one of my shows in high school. Being a Sea Scout, I did love a good submarine story. So, Melinda, how are you?
Well, I'm good, and thank you so much for inviting me, Josh. I really appreciate. May I call you Josh instead of Joshua?
Josh was only for signing checks and in court or depositions all their times. It's Josh. Okay.
No, yeah. I'm really excited to be taking part in this because, you know, Star Trek has always spent a lot of time playing around the edges of legal issues and certainly issues of, you know, rights and discrimination and, you know, on all of its history. The show has been very woke from the beginning back in the 1960s.
Yeah. And just for way of introduction, we were connected through our mutual friend, Tom Wang. I know Tom from Sea Scouts. He was my first bosun. And so we overlapped at Homestead High School. He was a senior when I was a freshman and a longtime friend. And we've had many adventures over the decades now. And Tom went to see me at Nerd Night San Francisco, where my talk was on Star Trek. And we opened with Measure of a Man because I felt that was suddenly timely. And Melinda, that's one of your episodes.
It's actually the episode that launched my Hollywood career. That was the first script I ever wrote. I was an artist, and my friend George R. R. Martin had gone out to Hollywood to work first on New Twilight Zone and then on Beauty and the Beast. And George called me one day and he said, hey, Snod, I think you'd be real good at this screenwriting thing. And if you want to write a spec script, I'll show it to my agent. And, you know, he said, you're really good with characterization. You write, you know, very good dialogue and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and then he explained to me, because this was all new to me. I'd been a lawyer and then become a novelist. So I was like, okay. And he explained that you never sell your spec script. Your spec script is just like a calling card. All it does is it presents you and your ability to write to potential, you know, showrunners or producers. And that if they like your spec script, then they'll have you come in to pitch more episodes. But you never sell your spec script. So I started thinking about what I wanted to do, and I looked at LA Law, and I thought, you know, that's too closely plotted. I don't know how to slide a script in there. I didn't want to write a script for Beauty and the Beast because George was on the show, and I didn't want to put him on the spot if I wrote a really bad script. And so I had grown up on Trek, and the new show had started, so I started watching. And Data was, to me, the most interesting character, which I've always thought was rather sad that the robot was more interesting than the people. But he at least had an arc. He had a place to grow. And so as I began to watch, I got this idea that I could use the Dred Scott decision, the infamous Dred Scott decision, and I could apply it to a robot who was, you know, in Starfleet. Is he a person? Or is he like the computer on the Enterprise? Is he property? But I called George and I said, look, I've got this idea for a script and I think it's really good. And if I'm never going to sell it, maybe I should write something else and save it for the pitch. And George gave me the best advice I've ever gotten for writing. He said, never hoard your silver bullet. Meaning lead with the very best thing you've got, the thing you're most passionate about, and write that. So I did. And he gave it to his agent, and then the Writers Guild went on strike for 6 months. And so I forgot about it. And then everything came back again when the strike ended, and George's agent sent it to Trek. And they not only bought the script, they then hired me to work on the show. So that's how it all, you know, happened. You know, so I'm forever grateful to that and to my legal education, because, you know, if I hadn't gone to law school and passed the bar and done all those things, I would never have been able to create that script. And I use it in a lot of my work, in my science fiction as well, in my novels too. So no education is wasted, kids. Go to school, go to college.
Well, so let's pivot to your first introduction to Star Trek. How did you first connect with it? Were you enamored by it? And then we can jump towards TNG.
Well, I had loved science fiction from the time I was a little kid. And my dad taught me to read before I went to school. My dad read a book a night. He was just, he had insomnia and he was a major reader. And he taught me to read. And what I was always drawn to were books of wonder, you know, what was out there and could I meet aliens and, you know, travel. I mean, I remember one of the first books I ever read was A Princess of Mars, all by myself, I mean, A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. And so that was just where I lived, I mean, emotionally, mentally. And then suddenly, as a little kid, there was a spaceship on my television screen. And that was, you know, because I had missed out on all the Rocky Jones and, you know, those other earlier things, but suddenly here was Trek. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with Spock, of course. And, you know, Kirk and McCoy and that relationship of those men. And so it was just a dream come true to get to see the things I had loved for so many years. Now suddenly it was there in front of me. And this view of a hopeful future where you had a woman who had authority, and a Black woman at that, you had a Russian, you had, you know, Asian, all on the bridge, and, you know, Earth was united, and, you know, what a beautiful concept it was. So that's where it started. And then, you know, along came Next Generation right at the time I kind of needed it in order to get myself, you know, launched as a screenwriter.
Thank you. It's good to see the intersection and the representation that's seen in Trek is a good introduction to DEI, because when the episode Court Martialed aired, in 1967, the attorney that we see, Lieutenant Arlene Shaw, only 3% of attorneys were women at that point in time.
Wow.
And this is from the ABA. So by 1989, when The Measure of a Man comes out, the number of female attorneys is 23%. And part of that, I have an autograph by Sandra Day O'Connor, and she credited Reagan appointing her to the Supreme Court as an increase of women started applying when she was appointed, just kind of, again, heading towards that better tomorrow. And today, I think the numbers are near parity for enrollment. But the current numbers, at least as of 2022, was that 38% of attorneys are female, which is, I mean, not yet parity, especially given the fact that law school is around even. And there's all kinds of reasons why female attorneys might not, you know, be at 50% because they leave the practice, something happens. But I mean, the numbers are improving, even though they did have a little dip during the pandemic. And I think that was because we had no plan for childcare where people had to stay home. It was just, no one ever planned that for that type of emergency. I mean, it's one thing to go duck and cover. It's another thing to go, no one can leave your house for the next 6 months.
Right. Yeah. Pardon me.
Yeah. So pivoting back to, you know, TNG and your breakout with this a beautiful story. You mentioned the Dred Scott opinion, which was, you know, 200 pages of terror by, you know, Chief Justice Taney. That was, I think, March 7th, 1857. because President Buchanan at his inauguration said the matter of slavery will be settled once and for all. And that was March 4th. And then 3 days later, we get this abomination, which said that Black people could never be US citizens. Like that's the punchline. And it is horrific to read. It ensured the Civil War. This episode, you have a lot of legal concepts that are floating around and very prevalent, you know, two being equal protection and due process. Were you thinking in those terms when you wrote the script?
I was, but I also knew that I had 47 minutes, and I also knew that, you know, it was a military setting. And so I have to credit a dear friend of mine. He was a Navy aviator captain and retired, and we were friends. And I was working on the script, and, you know, we were having lunch together. And I said to him, he's, what are you working on? I told him about, I was writing the spec script and what it was about. And Jerry Weber said to me, you know, when a ship is at sea and we don't have JAG available, he said, the captain always defends and the first officer always prosecutes.
Oh.
That was the piece that I needed, you know, because it allowed me to have actual conflict and drama, which was not easy to get into Next Generation. Gene was protecting his legacy, and, you know, he even told us in a meeting, my people are perfect, they have no flaws. And I was like, I don't know how to write about that. But this was a case where, you know, they were pitted against each other. And so that just, you know, elevated it and gave me something that, you know, so I could kind of use my training and the constitutional legal issues, and also use some of the military to pull in and create, you know, up the drama and for this story. So everything came together kind of perfectly. So
that's very cool. And being able to work in that angle. One of the things I've presented about, and several friends have presented about on this episode, is what Riker's duty of competency and whether or not that was in any way compromised by his relationship with Data. And, you know, the ABA rule language is the personal relationship, did it substantially affect? And the way that he goes after Data and that damning cross-examination, clearly not, clearly not his ethical duty. Were you
in a civilian setting, but in a military setting, that was his job, you know?
Yeah. You had the JAG captain actually be the same rank as Picard, which was a nice spin since Shaw was lower ranking than Kirk and they had a relationship, which was, there's all kinds of problems with that today. But again, it was nice evolution to see that the another captain who was a Picard's equal, which was that intentional? Did anyone say, don't do that or encourage you to do that?
No, I just, she kind of popped into my head, and I liked her, you know, Philippa, she was fun. I hinted a backstory between them, but I never explained, you know, that she went after him over, you know, my feeling is Picard was too perfect. So I figure he had a giant screw up somewhere early on, and she was the person brought in to go after him after they'd had a torrid affair, but she didn't let it change anything about how she did her job. It's just always this kind of backstory. You know, I like that kind of tensions that you don't fully explain, but they're there to, just give you something more crunchy, if you will, you know, in the episode or the book or whatever it is you're doing, you know, creatively, what you can do with it. I had a couple of things I had to change. One was the teaser. I created the poker game.
Oh, good for you.
That was the first time the poker game ever. And it happened because the initial teaser I had written was Data trying to learn how to swim, and that he'd read every book and he'd done, you know, he had it all down, except Data weighs 300 pounds, as I found out from our tech guys. And so he goes to go swimming and he gets in the water and he sinks like a stone. And then he just sort of walks across the bottom and comes out the other side. And my boss, Morris Hurley, you know, after he bought the script and they had hired me, he said, first of all, we're terrible at going on location. And he said, also, we can't put Brent in the water because his makeup will wash off.
Oh.
So you have to come up with something else where all the research in the world won't do the robot any good. And so poker was the logical, because bluffing, you know, all of the things that would seem illogical to him, you know, would. So that was how that happened. And then the other major change was initially Whoopi wasn't in the script. I didn't have Guinan in the script. And Maury called me into the office, to his office, and he said, we've been looking over Whoopi's contract and she's guaranteed X many episodes this season. And if we don't put her in Measure of a Man, we're not going to meet our contractual obligations. Oops. So please go write a Guinan. We need a Guinan scene. And that was, and then he said, oh, and you've got 3 hours because we have a production meeting. And I was like, oh my God. So, you know, thankfully, law school and being a lawyer, you learn to work under pressure at a time, you know. So I paced around for, you know, 2 hours and actually almost came down and said, okay, I've got an idea. And I ran it past Maury. And, you know, we kicked around a few more ideas. We, you know, the way writers do it, we sort of brainstormed. And then he said, you've got it, go write it. And, you know, in many ways, I think that's the heart of the episode, is that moment between Picard and Guinan, where she leads him, you know, to realize what's really at stake. If they can make thousands of Datas, then, you know, what does that pretend? And then what was so weird to me in the Picard series is that obviously everybody ignored that completely and they made a whole bunch of robots that then blew up Mars. So I was like, did you not actually look at the episode? You know?
Yeah, I was struck by that in season one of Picard as well, because it's like, you did the thing you didn't, you said was a bad thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, nobody went, hey, there was this case, you know, we had when we did the thing. And no, nobody apparently ever did that. So it was very strange.
Well, I had problems with seasons one and two of Picard. Season three left me crying and cheering in most episodes. So they really figured it out at the end, and I'm very grateful for that.
My friend Rick Manning said, Star Trek, for those of us who work there, put the S and the T in PTSD. So the only reason I watched Picard season one was because I suddenly had all these fans getting in touch with me on Twitter and Facebook and everything, saying, did you know they based the entire first season of Picard on your episode? And I went, really? Because honestly, I haven't watched any Star Trek since I left the show. I mean, it was that much PTSD. But I'm very grateful because it launched my Hollywood career. So, and I got the right Measure of a Man. So that alone is, you know.
Okay, it's one of the seminal episodes, because it's one of the people ask questions about, because we've done many Star Trek law presentations because it's a good foil. And you know, we've done, each series has at least one trial episode. Deep Space Nine averaged a trial a season. So I don't know who loved the law on that one, but they gave us lots of content. You know, the law always has standards and tests, and you came up with a test for, you know, with the character Maddox for figuring out what is being alive, sentient. What was your inspiration for that?
Well, I think, you know, all the science fiction books I had read, you know, the robot books by Isaac Asimov, and, you know, these various questions of, you know, what is sentience? And also, you know, thinking about what a true AI, what true AI means. I mean, that had been something we're all struggling with now, especially with Chat GPT or however, whatever the which isn't true AI. You know, it's a minor bird. It just mines through other people's prose and scripts and then tries to create something. But if you had true sentience, if the creature is self-aware, and you know, what will a feral AI want to do? And you know, all of those issues, and how do you define that? And ultimately, you know, it was, and it's funny because I'm not religious, but coming down to the idea of, you know, does Data have a soul? I mean, does he have the right to figure out who he is and what he wants? And you know, as I had Philippa say, it sits there looking at me, and I don't know, you know, but I have to give it a chance. And so all of those questions were there. I mean, you know, how much free will does he have? You know, is it all programming? But then you could make the argument that we're all programming too. I mean, chemical responses in the brain dictate how humans react. I mean, we're machines too. We're fleshy machines, but we're still machines. And so I had to sort of work through all of those things and again, find a way to make it explicable and realistic enough in 47 minutes. I mean, that's always a challenge in, you know, in TV.
Having organized mock trials at Comic-Con, and it's like where you have 45 minutes, you know, and you want questions to do a full trial. It's like, okay. It's like each side, you have 3 minutes for your opening. You know, direct and cross can each be 4. And, you know, there's 2 witnesses. So everyone stay on topic and your closings are each 5 minutes. Go. And you have an episode with plot. It's not all courtroom. So it's, I mean, again, it's at the Comic-Con 2016, we did a Star Trek panel. And one of the panelists included a former federal magistrate judge named Paul Graywall. He's now at Coinbase. He has the distinction of being the first federal judge to appear at Comic-Con on a panel. Now former California Supreme Court Justice Manuel Florentino Cuellar, and who's brilliant. His wife is Judge Lucy Coe on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Reportedly, both of them were on President Obama's shortlist for the Supreme Court. So smart, very nice, loves Trek. And hearing him and Graywall debate this issue, Graywall came down on the side of AI possibly could be alive at some point. And Cuellar took issue with that of like, we can't be at the point where, no, excuse me, it was reversed. Cuellar took that position, Graywall did not. And Graywall getting into the issue of, do you upgrading an operating system should not require a test on whether or not the operating system is alive. It was, again, hearing two intellectual giants debate something that complex at Comic-Con rocked. It was one we didn't record and I regret it. So,
oh gosh, yeah, I would love to have heard that. I mean,
again, it was all your episode. Now, looking ahead, okay, you just said that you have Star Trek PTSD, but let's just say that you were going to be the Star Trek or a series writer on a Star Trek legal series. Just Star Trek law. What kinds of legal issues would you want to explore in that universe?
Oh gosh, conflict of laws. I mean, that would be a huge one. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was actually a debate I had with Gene. we're kind of lucky Measure got made because Gene made the argument that there are no lawyers in the 24th century. And that Data would be delighted to be disassembled. At which point I said to him, well, then, Mr. Runbury, we don't have a script, you know, because And I said to him, I said, sir, I'm sorry, but there have to be lawyers. I mean, lawyers have to exist in the 21st century. He said, no, no, no. If people want to do bad things, we get their minds right. And I said, okay. Apart from the fact that that was creepy, which I did not say to him, but, you know, I was polite. But I pointed out, I said, there's much more to law than just criminal law. There's family law. There's child custody issues. There's treaties. There's contracts. There's conflict of laws. And you're going to have these issues because you have Vulcans and, you know, Klingons and different legal systems that have to somehow find a way to work together. And I loved conflicts in university. I thought that was a great course. And so I just think we could do an entire series dealing with these issues, and it would be fabulous. And by the way, CBS, I'm available after the strike ends. I think a science fiction legal show, especially a Star Trek legal show, could be dynamite. I mean, you know, federal, you know, who the, do they ride circuit? I mean, do we have, you know, federal, to the equivalent of John Marshall riding circuit, you know, out to the various places. And, you know, I actually wrote a book series about that, you know, and does the Constitution follow the flag? And, you know, all of these questions that could be raised. And I think that it's just endless opportunities. And I mean, you know, actually the Orville, which is a show that I love.
Yes.
Actually really got into this conflict of laws issue on the issue of the culture that only has males. And, you know, forcibly changing a child's gender to fit the norm. And yet, you know, that was anathema to the, you know, the human government. And so how do you resolve all that? I don't think they wrote a great courtroom argument. I think better arguments could have been made, but it was still, at least they raised the issue. So I would love to do that. I'd love to.
Yeah, and I would love you to do that as well. And also because it would be ballpark correct. Like, you would make an effort for it to be right. What happens with producers and showrunners and everything else after that, you know, subject to change. One of my friends and I were just on Strange New Pod talking about the trial episode of Strange New Worlds that just aired.
Right.
And we Nari and I each had big problems with the attorney in that, because like, you, it's not about the lawyer, it's about the client. Like, just, you know, like, and but it was a reason to be able to talk about how to do a cross-examination, what not to do in a cross-examination, why it's a bad idea to attack a witness, you know, all of those things. And they asked, the host of that podcast were very curious about the conflict of laws and choice of law, of like, why are we following Earth as opposed, and specifically the United States, as opposed to like what Vulcans might have or Andorians. And my theory on that is, one, I'm like, it's being written and made in, you know, Hollywood. So like, that's, it's like, we're leaning into what we know. A canon explanation might be from Enterprise with, you know, Earth and, you know, Captain Archer, kind of the glue for the Federation to come together, and a legal framework from the United States at least could make sense if they're, since that's where they're from, and gluing together the Federation. But yeah, it's, what's, there was one of the Henry Mudd episodes from the original series where Vulcans have his patent infringement, the death penalty. Like, that's hardcore.
Okay. That's like the Chinese communist government, you know. I mean, we, single bullet we spare for you, you know.
We don't do that.
We don't do that. I mean, hello.
It might disgorge profits and cost lots of money, but we don't shoot you like that. I mean, this is fascinating. And I mean, you also wrote pen pals, Up the Long Ladder, The Instance of Command, The High Ground. Any others?
Well, I did a lot of rewriting. I mean, when you're on staff on a TV show, you, especially when a freelancer's, I did the rewrite on, you know, Data Makes a Kid. Yeah, I did the rewrite on that one. You know, you do a lot of work and you know, you share. I mean, sometimes a script comes in and it's really a mess and you're under the time pressure. And so everybody, I don't know if I should say this, you can edit it, I guess. It's called a gangbang. It's like, okay, Josh, you take the teaser in act one. Melinda, you've got act two. You know, Ira, you do act three. And you divvy it up and everybody goes and rewrites that act. And then we give it to a single person like Ira, or at the time, you know, I love it, Michael Piller. And then they run it through their word processor and make it all sort of maybe flow together, even though it was written by five different people, you know, and make it try to look like it was written by one person. And then, you know, if you're a good guy, you never put your name on a freelancer script that you rewrite, because that's, you know, you let them get the residual money because you're getting paid a salary and you're getting paid for your scripts. And so you don't jump credit. So, you know, we did a lot of that. So our names don't appear, even though we, you know, like my name is not on The Child or whichever way, because I don't do that to people. You know, you don't jump credit. So.
Very noble and the right thing to do. So we've talked a lot about Data from TNG. In all of Trek, who is your favorite character?
Oh, gosh. I think Spock, because he was so tortured. And people in conflict with him, the human heart, or even the Vulcan heart, or the half-Vulcan heart in conflict with itself, is wonderful, wonderful stuff. I think it's Faulkner who said that, you know, good fiction is about the human heart in conflict with itself. And he epitomizes that. And so I love that character. And in some ways it's agony for me not to watch Strange New Worlds, because the other character I've always thought, somebody asked me on a panel once who, they were interviewing me about Trek and said, if you could serve under any captain, who would it be? And I said, it would be Pike. And they were like, why? And I said, because he could make Spock smile. And the fact that he inspired such devotion and loyalty that Spock would risk his entire career in order to give him peace, take him to a place where he could find peace and finish out his life, tells me that he was one, you know, hell of a guy, you know, that he must have been an amazing commander. And so, you know, I'm sort of torn because, you know, a part of me wants to watch it, but, you know, I hear that theme, PTSD, oh boy.
it's a beautiful show. I deeply enjoy it. Pike is quickly becoming my favorite captain. And part of it is Anson Mount just seems to be like such a good guy.
Yes.
Just, you see him on social media, it's like, you seem cool. Like we could barbecue. Like
let's get together. Yeah.
What do we want to do? Tacos, name it, we'll figure it out. Like he just seems, and the most recent episode, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, very well done. So I would encourage you to check it out, but the PTSD factor, I completely understand. But they do a lot of good work on that show. So I would say check it out.
No, I friends of mine have told me, you know, it's just, you know, we presented a beautiful world, but sometimes the reality of behind the scenes on Hollywood can be very different than what we're putting out there for people to actually watch, you know. Well, as we now know, if anybody's been reading Burn It Down by Mo Ryan, you know, like what went on Lost and, you know, all these things. That, so that's the, it's getting better though. It is definitely getting better. So.
Well, that in the Trek documentaries, I mean, you know, Chaos on the Bridge and other ones highlight, things sounded radically weird and complex in the early days of TNG, and that had to be hard. So,
and I was the only woman above the line. I was the only, only woman on staff who was above the line. So,
wow. Did you interact with DC Fontana at all?
No, I knew Dorothy because we had mutual friends in common, and so we would get together. And, you know, but she had left the show before I started on the show, because I came in halfway through the second season after the strike ended. So I did half the second season, all of the third season, and then I said, I'm done. And actually, I never intended to go back to Hollywood. I was going to come home and write books again, because I was really burnt. But then I got a job on Reasonable Doubts, which was a lawyer cop show, and it changed everything. I learned so much from my boss, Bob Singer, who was terrific. And I was the only actual attorney on that writing staff. So it was fun to get to kind of, you know, help guide and say, no, we don't want to do that. Let's, you know, we can massage this in a different way. We can tell a different kind of story. So that was, you know, that was really fun to do and to work on that show. Although at one point we were breaking a story, you know, the staff was together. We were plotting out this new episode, and I kept saying, no, they would never tell them where the body is buried. That's not lawyers. We don't do that. You know, and I was explaining all this. And then finally, one of my coworkers turned to me and said, now I understand why we all hate lawyers. You know, I was like, sorry.
Part of the reason why we ended up starting Legal Geeks was, again, we love pop culture, whether it's, again, Big Trek fans. Jessica is a huge Edgar Rice Burroughs fan, and I've gotten her, you know, gifts on him over the years as well, because, again, she loves Princess of Mars and John Connor or Carter, and just like means a lot to her. So hearing these adventures, it's like, okay, that's telling. I don't know if you realize this, but with Tom, when we did a series of short stories, he dedicated that book to you. And I don't know if you, yeah. So the Unlock Stories book is dedicated to you. And, you know, the premise was, it's a smartphone that goes from, it's the recurring motif. So like that goes from each chapter. It's like mine was on an app that allowed you to text with dead people. Mm-hmm. And the implications there when you realize, oh, there is an afterlife and what that could do. And mine's the only good feel-good story. But with, you know, the horrors that you could have from that realization. But I know Tom's very fond of you. And so I, if you hadn't seen that, I wanted you to know.
I did not know. And now I'm probably blushing because that's amazing. But thank him for me. That's incredible. Wow.
It was, again, it was pre-pandemic. And each is a unique take, because you have very different people writing, you know, a little short story where the phone's found and then picked and then lost at the end. So and you get a good glimpse into how people think. But that said, I just want to thank you for your time. This has been so lovely to be able to chat with you, because I've talked about this episode a lot over the years, being able to see how you came up with it and the everything that went into the making of it.
It was an amazing experience, and I'm grateful for the opportunity, and you know, it's interesting because the show is used in so many different venues, as in classrooms, I mean, in law schools, in philosophy classes, in AI classes. And I actually ended up talking to the Air Force Cyber Command because they teach Measure of Man during their courses. And I'm not sure all these military officers were exactly certain why they were watching the Star Trek episode and why they were talking to me. But the JAG officer, he and I had a really fun conversation, you know, as we debated. So, you know, I just think law is the foundation for a civilized society. And if you don't have it, and so it's infinitely fascinating and worth discussing.
Well, and Star Trek, I mean, that the view of the Federation, like, wouldn't exist without laws. You would have laws that would protect your rights to exist, so you don't have governments enacting terrible things. So in order to have that diverse society where people can live freely together, that's based upon law. And it's like, we're right before the 4th of July. It's like thinking about that. The Declaration to our Bill of Rights, it's like all of that's based upon law of how we got to where we are. So how can people see any of the books that you've written, check out other works that you've done? How can people see your material?
Well, right at the moment, I've had to change publishers. And so my books are being, you know, once more, we're getting them available. At the moment, you can get books from Beastly Books in Santa Fe, New Mexico. They, you can order them there. There are Audible, I have, you know, audiobooks of my work. And I'm there. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Spoutable, I'm sort of everywhere. Instagram, although I'm not very good at it because I'm a word person, not a picture person. But, you know, there aren't that many snodgrasses in the wild, so you can probably find me pretty easily. I love to interact with people. I'm happy to, you know, be a mentor. I can't read your material if it's not published, folks, because then I'll get in trouble. And it's a risk to me. Both my Hollywood manager and my editors would not love me and publishers if I did that. No, please stop by, say hi. I always have fun group of people. And we talk about writing and dressage because I'm a horsewoman and movies and just all kinds of things. So that's how they can find me.
Are you going to any cons in the next few months?
I'm actually not. I might go to the New York Comic Con. My wild cards, I do a series of books with George R. Martin called Wild Cards. George and I created the universe and we co-edit together. We have 29 or 30 books. And I've done a big graphic novel set in the Wild Cards universe, and it's going to be released and premiered at the New York Comic Con. So I'm thinking about going to that, and it'll be in October. So, you know, COVID has put a big damper on my travel. I'm a little bit careful about going places and you know, you sort of fall out of the habit. And I may go to BossCon in Boston in February, which is a very fun literary convention. So
I prefer events where I can drive. WonderCon, you know, the events in LA from the Bay Area, that's like a 5-hour drive. Like I can handle that. San Diego crosses into 7. That's a lot harder to pull off because
I've lived in LA on and off a lot, and yeah, it's fighting your way down to San Diego from LA is like it can take 3 hours or it can take 5 hours and you have no way to know. So it's the airplane thing. It's, you know, I'm a little bit being in airports and in airplanes, and you know, because whether or not people want to accept it, COVID is still out there, you know. But get your boosters, get your shots, you know, don't be silly.
Well, the airlines keep having problems too. So like, that's the other half of it.
Yeah. I don't want to be stranded in Dallas. Thank you very much. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I'm good. So no, thank you. But we'll be at San Diego. So we will, I just need to figure out if I'm flying or driving, and we'll have lots to talk about there. So, Melinda, thank you so much for your time. Have a wonderful 4th of July holiday. And for all else who've tuned in today, thank you. Stay healthy, stay safe, and above all else, stay geeky. Take care.